Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm George Dobbins, Vice President of Programs at the Commonwealth Club, and your moderator for today's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Bob Barr, former U.S. Congressman and former Libertarian Party candidate for president. Bob Barr represented the 7th District of Georgia as a Republican congressman from 1995 to 2003. In 2006, he joined the Libertarian Party and was the 2008 Libertarian Party nominee for President of the United States. From 2003 to 2008, he occupied the 21st Century Liberties Chair for Freedom and Privacy at the American Conservative Union. Mr. Barr was appointed by President Reagan to serve as the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Georgia from 1986 to 90 and served as President of Southeastern Legal Foundation in 1990 and 91. He was an official with the CIA from 1971 to 78. He's a member of the Constitution's Project Initiative on Liberty and Security, and he served from 2003 to 2005 as a member of the project at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, addressing matters of privacy and security. In recognizing Bob Barr's leadership in privacy matters, New York Times columnist William Safire has called him Mr. Privacy. Currently, Bob Barr writes a weekly column for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and a monthly opinion piece for James Magazine. He's hosted nationally syndicated weekly radio show and served as a contributing editor for the American Spectator. He practices law with the law offices of Edwin Marger and runs a consulting firm, Liberty Strategies, Inc., headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia. Bob Barr was awarded his law degree from Georgetown University and obtained a master's degree from the George Washington University and his bachelor's degree from the University of Southern California. Today he will be discussing James Madison and the original Federalists and their relevance to America's current problems. Please give a warm welcome to Bob Barr.
Thank you. Thank you, George, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for the temerity of inviting me back. I think this is perhaps the third time that I've had the honor and the pleasure of being with you all to share what far too few of our fellow citizens engage in, and that is a spirited but civil debate on current issues of public concern, public policy matters. I think the work that the Commonwealth Club does, if not unique, certainly is among the most important of any civic organization in our country, and it's indeed a real honor to be with you all. 1 week ago today, I was in quite a different environment. I was over at Oxford in the UK, speaking over there. And the audience was somewhat small compared to the audience that I had enjoyed listening to me the time I had been over there a couple of years before. And I asked one of my hosts, one of the students at the Oxford Union, whether it was something that had to do with my appearance or whether there was something going on that depressed attendance. And they said, Courtney Love. And I said, excuse me. And Courtney Love was speaking at Oxford the very same night that I was there and apparently enjoyed a much larger audience. I have no earthly idea why, but I'm glad that she's not here tonight so that we have a larger audience here. Also appreciated George's instruction or request. I'm not sure he's probably too nice to use, say, an instruction, but his request to turn off cell phones. It does make the job the federal government to locate you just slightly more difficult, which I always enjoy doing. Also appreciate being at a forum at which a colleague of mine in the law and a fellow professor, much more distinguished than I am. I've recently become an adjunct professor at the John Marshall Law School in Atlanta and teach just one course a week in constitutional law, but John Yoo, who has appeared recently, as I understand it, here in this forum. John is a friend of mine. We disagree on many issues, and we actually debate on a fairly regular basis. But I know that whether individuals among us might agree or disagree with John, it's always a good debate with John because he is like so many of probably all of the folks that you have visited here, very civil but very knowledgeable about the issues about which he spoke, and I'll probably actually be touching on a couple of the same issues, perhaps that John Yoo spoke about, presidential power, and including both from an historical standpoint as well as a current standpoint, constitutional powers, constitutional issues this evening. Let me begin, though, with a reference to a movie. Now, I don't have time to go out to the movies an awful lot, but my wife and I went to a movie recently, and it was actually a fairly good movie. And it came to mind as I was giving some thought at John's George's instruction for preparing for tonight. The movie is called The Book of Eli. I don't know whether any of you all have seen it. It's I think, at least in Atlanta, currently still out in the theaters. But it's a very interesting movie, and the reason that I thought of this movie, The Book of Eli, is because it involves, not surprising from the title, a book, the word, the written word. And the point of the movie, there are a number of points to it, and it's a fairly interesting movie, and I don't want to certainly give away the punchline to it, but it involves a written word, it involves a book, and the point of the movie is that words have power, words have meaning, and the written word actually provides, if it is in fact based on principle and ideas with which we as human beings exercising our mind agree, then it has value. We ought to pay attention to it, we ought to cherish it, and we ought to consistently follow those principles and those ideas. Now, the book that was the subject matter of the Book of Eli, the movie, was not the two documents about which I want to center our discussion here this evening, but the principle is the same. Words have meaning. Written words, particularly those that are crafted and drafted and writ, to provide a framework within which our lives as citizens of this great land of ours should operate, do have meaning. And the documents about which I speak are first and foremost the Constitution of the United States of America, including its Bill of Rights, adopted shortly thereafter, and the successive amendments, but primarily the amendments incorporating the Bill of Rights and the Constitution itself as one document. The other that I will refer to this evening, that I suspect all of us have at least some passing familiarity with, is a collection of papers that Thomas Jefferson, not one of the authors of these, but as one of our founding fathers, described a number of times, many years later, as one of the great bodies of written political thought in the world, not just in the U.S., but in the world, and I speak of the Federalist Papers. And I think frequently about the Federalist Papers, certainly not simply because I teach them and refer to them in my class on constitutional law, but because they are so important and so relevant to what goes on in our government today, just as they were with regard to things that went on in our government in its very founding days, well over two centuries ago. And I do lament that so few, both my former colleagues as well as those now occupying public office in Washington from the highest position, namely the President of the United States, on down through members of Congress, members of the Senate, members of the administration, and predecessor administrations. This has nothing to do with what letter of the alphabet follows one's name, whether it's an R or a D, an L or an I. It has everything to do with people in Washington in high public office dealing with matters of life and death and the very survival of our nation, its economy, and its social fabric, having no more interest in or familiarity with the Constitution of the United States or the Federalist Papers, which adds so much to the substance, the meat of the words that are in that that relatively short document known as the Constitution, than they do with any other book that might be in a library. And it's a real shame. I do lament the fact that when we see discussions that pass loosely for a debate in Washington, or we see presidential debates, and I use the word in quotes, every 4 years. They are no more like a debate than watching two school kids argue about something on a playground. But when we see these and we see even something which should be as profound and monumental and important as a State of the Union addressed by a president, deteriorate into nothing than successive, repetitive sound bites interrupted by unthinking applause and members of Congress bouncing up and down like jumping jacks. At least I yearn for the days back when we had some true substantive discourse, some real debates over these issues. And we suffer, I think, as a nation and as individuals when that is missing. Now, the Constitution itself is a relatively short document. The copy that I carry in my folder over there is published by a group out of Washington called the Cato Institute. There are, of course, any number of other versions out there, but the Cato version, the Constitution itself occupies about 20 pages and about 3 pages for the Bill of Rights and about another dozen or so pages for the remainder of the amendments that have been adopted since the Constitution itself was adopted. So a total of about 36 pages. And yet it is the most profound, most positive framework within which to organize a society and a government and the relationship between the people and the government, between the governed and the governed, that has ever been written. I was over, as I mentioned, over in Europe just last week in the UK and had an opportunity during the program that I was involved with over there to leaf through a document that had been given to me. And it is the European version of our Constitution. The thing is, and I don't recall exactly, but several hundred pages long. And I dare say that those who allow themselves or permit themselves to be governed by a document with that sort of gratuitous detail in it, trying to catalog everything that its drafters could think of that might come before the European governing body, will be doomed to however many years they consent to serve under such a document, will be doomed to incessant arguing over what those words mean. Now, with our Constitution, certainly, we have, and thankfully we have had over the years, some outstanding debates, both in the legal arena and decisions rendered by our Supreme Court and other so-called Article III or federal courts, as well as certainly debates over momentous legislation over the course of our history. Not much of that goes on nowadays, but for those of us as students of history and public policy over the course of our nation's history, we're well familiar with these debates, and those of us who are students of the law are very familiar, of course, with the momentous decisions that have been had. But where you have, and I was struck by this, for example, in the most recent presidential address to the Congress when President Obama delivered his State of the Union address just a few short weeks ago, and he took the not unheard of, but the unusual step of referring to a specific Supreme Court decision during his State of the Union. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I'd be delighted for a president to actually be aware of a Supreme Court decision if, in fact, that chief executive, that president, did not deliberately and very clearly mischaracterize, for political reasons, to score political points, mischaracterize the position, the opinion of the Supreme Court to which he referred. The case at hand was a case involving our federal campaign laws. The case was called Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. The Citizens United is an organization in Washington, D.C., a conservative-oriented public interest organization. And the case that that had resulted in this very important Supreme Court decision to which President Obama referred during his State of the Union address basically had found constitutional defects and flaws in some provisions of the campaign finance law that Senator McCain had championed and with the law which bears his name, the McCain-Feingold Federal Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. The president deliberately mischaracterized the decision, was not held accountable for doing so. As a matter of fact, was applauded by certainly members of his party there present in the House chamber listening to the State of the Union. What happened after that was particularly distressing, because you had sitting directly in front of the president, much as you all are here in the House chamber as the president was delivering his State of the Union address, you had seated there, I forget whether it was all or most, of the Supreme Court justices, the justices of the United States Supreme Court. The president mischaracterized this Citizens United case as opening the floodgates to campaign corporations buying elections and giving money to candidates. The case, of course, had nothing to do with donations by corporations. It had simply to do with whether or not corporations should continue to enjoy, as they have pursuant to laws in this country and cases in this country for many, many decades, First Amendment rights to express their views and to pay money for advertising. It had nothing to do with corporations contributing directly to candidates. That remains against the federal law. But the president saw an opportunity to throw out a soundbite there, to beat up on corporations, to do it directly as the Supreme Court justices were sitting there in front of them, which I thought was in bad taste, made worse by what happened next. And that is what appeared to be all the Democratic members of the Senate and the House that were there stood, and they didn't jeer, but through their clapping, they basically, that's what they were doing, looking at and clapping at the Supreme Court justices, mimicking the president's criticism of them. This tells us several things. One, that those who occupy high office in our land continue to have a little regard for the accuracy or the truth of cases that come out of the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court. They have a little understanding of the issues involved, and even less concern for using those decisions in ways that are productive, as opposed to simply temporary scoring a temporary political advantage through throwing out a court decision as a soundbite. Members of the Congress, those who stood and applaud, basically figuratively jeering the Supreme Court as the justices were sitting there, have similarly displayed very little regard for the propriety of the occasion and certainly the importance and professionalism. Whether one agrees or disagrees with the court decision is not the point. One needs to do so based on facts, not on mischaracterization, and to do so in a civil and appropriate way. Yet this is about as close as we come in Washington these days to anything that even approaches at least a reference to or a discussion of important substantive issues. We see precious little of that. I do applaud the president, and I hope that he continues, for example, to do what he did. I think it was a few days after that, I don't recall the sequence of events, but the president went to the Republican caucus. At the beginning of each session of the Congress, the Democrats go off and have their caucus somewhere for a weekend, and the Republicans do the same. There was an effort long, long ago in a different era entirely when I served in the Congress where there was an effort for about three sessions to have bipartisan retreats. A revolutionary idea at the time. Unfortunately, neither the leadership of the Republican nor the Democratic parties continued the effort. Had they done so, I think that we would have at least a more civil, less rancorous, and slightly more substantive series of policy debates in Washington than we've had since. But unfortunately, that series of bipartisan retreats did not take hold back in the late 1990s, and we've now reverted to the Democrats going off and doing their caucus at the beginning of each session of the Congress. The Republicans go off and do theirs, and there is absolutely no cross-pollination. There's no effort to talk these issues outside of the halls of the Congress or the committee meetings, which do not lend themselves to substantive debate and continual debate. But the president did something that is highly unusual, and I commend him for him, and that is he, after, I think it was after the State of the Union, but it might have been right before, he went to the Republican retreat and actually spoke to and with and took questions from the Republicans. Now, both sides did an awful lot of posturing. Unfortunately, the whole program was televised. It probably would have been a little better if they had had both the televised part and a portion of the program that that was not publicized, so that there was some effort to actually engage in debate as opposed to creating sound bites for the camera. But if, in fact, the president continues that effort and is serious about it, I think it will help immensely. But he can't do it himself. It's going to take an awful lot of work and very conscious effort to break the partisanship that we have in Washington that is born of and facilitated by what we in this country have allowed to become a monopoly two-party system that centers around one party being in charge, one party not being in charge, one party controlling the levers of power, one party not controlling anything except whatever time they can wrest from the what are now the arbiters of public debate, that is the cable networks, whatever time they can wrest from that. I am afraid that as long as we continue down the path of providing two parties and two parties only, clothed with the aura of legitimacy that are enabled by a series of campaign laws and laws at the states that freeze out competition, that freezes out open debate. We see this every 4 years in the fact that the so-called presidential and vice presidential debates, not debates, but that's what they call them, deal with two parties and two parties only, unless, as we saw the last, about 18 years ago, when Ross Perot was allowed to participate in the 1992 presidential debate. He was not allowed to participate, but for the fact that the Republican campaign of then President Bush seeking re-election decided in a very ill-advised political decision, decided that if they had Ross Perot as part of the debate in 1992 as against then-candidate Bill Clinton, that it would help Mr. Bush. As it turned out, it didn't. It was a bad calculation on their part. But had not the Bush campaign insisted that Mr. Perot be admitted to the debate, he would not have been. And since then, we have not had either of the two major party, monopoly party candidates or campaigns that have felt sufficiently threatened or see a sufficient advantage to do something that other societies do as a matter of course, and that is to believe that more ideas, more voices, particularly in a campaign for the highest off the land, is better rather than fewer and more limited voices. And we have not had any openness whatsoever, and consequently we get what we get. We get, for example, 6 hours of debates in the last presidential campaign in which the following word was mentioned by my count one time. The word was the Constitution. It was mentioned one time in passing, I think, by Senator Biden in the vice presidential debate. There is no discussion in these campaigns or in these so-called debates of the Constitution, of such things as the Federalist Papers. And I grant you, there are many more exciting treatises out there and books out there and pamphlets out there than the Federalist Papers. And I'm not saying that those ought to provide the only vehicle where through which these issues are discussed. But returning to them, understanding them, simply being familiar with them, being familiar with the tremendous eloquence of a James Madison when he says, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. But of course, as he also realized, men are not angels. We are not governed by angels. And he admonished us in the very next paragraph, the very next sentence, as a matter of fact, that it is as much a job of government to provide a governing framework within which freedom can operate among the citizenry as it is to govern the governed. The government exists to keep the government within bounds and to make sure that it abides by what the Constitution requires of the president, yet is very often ignored, and that is to make sure that the laws be faithfully executed. And let me conclude with a reference to my good friend John Yoo. When John Yoo and I debated last, which was about a week and a half ago in Chicago, and he may have touched on this issue when he appeared before you all about a month ago, George. He talks about the importance for presidents, in his view, to serve as a strong commander-in-chief, to not be anchored to old traditions and to the views of the day. To John, and I paraphrase certainly, those presidents that he believes are the best and the greatest among our history are those that took that one clause in the Constitution that the president serves as commander-in-chief and pushed it as far and in as many directions as possible. That is, you know, great and bold leadership. I disagree. What I would like to see us gauge our presidents by is not how great a commander-in-chief they can be. That is an important job of the president, but is not the most important one. The most important job of that president is the fact that it is their explicit responsibility to see that the laws be faithfully executed, and that means as to them as well. So that is the hallmark, the criteria that I use when I look across the great history of our land and the presidents, the men that have occupied that office and other offices, and it leaves me wanting. Because we don't see that anymore. We see it, even references to it so infrequently. So I appreciate George and the membership of the Commonwealth Club of California inviting me back once again to discuss these issues. I just wish that there were Commonwealth Clubs of California all across this country, in cities and communities, large and small, so that these issues did receive the conscious treatment and debate that they do here. It helps our country immensely. What you are doing is in the great tradition of our founding fathers, and I appreciate it as a citizen of Georgia. I appreciate what you all do here, and I appreciate the opportunity to once again be with you this evening. Thank you.
Our thanks to Bob Barr, former U.S. Congressman and former Libertarian Party candidate for president. It's now time for our audience question period, and Mr. Barr, we have quite a number of questions, as you can see, so we're going to try to get to a good smattering of them. They break down into several categories: questions about the Federalist, questions about political issues in general, and questions about yourself. So we'll try to cover a few of everything. Let me start with a question about the Federalists. This is a questioner who asks, are politicians just simply much more ignorant today than they used to be? Is that why they can't concentrate on the writings of the Federalists and hearken back to what was originally intended?
That's certainly part of it. I have to tell you that I served on three different committees when I was in the Congress: the Judiciary, the Government Reform, and the Financial Services. The Judiciary Committee, and I think our counterpart over on the Senate side, the same would hold. We did have, in fact, very regular, very good debates. And the members of the Judiciary Committee, with very, very few exceptions on both sides of the aisle, so to speak, were familiar with the Constitution. They did read the laws and understand what we were debating. But that is that membership is the exception rather than the rule for the Congress as a whole. There is very, very little interest in really understanding the Constitution, much less the Federalist Papers. Many pieces of legislation, particularly those that are fairly lengthy, but not only those that are lengthy, most pieces of legislation are never read by members of the House or the Senate. And I'm not saying that before a member votes on every piece of legislation that they have to read every word. They'd be doing nothing up there except reading. But they ought to at least be familiar with it, for heaven's sakes. That's why you have staff up there. Use the staff to actually read, brief you, sit down with you, and go over this stuff. It wouldn't take any more time than it takes to attend a couple of receptions generally. But its lack of its ignorance, its lack of understanding of the history, the meaning of the Constitution, the meaning of our government, and it also, I think, George, has to do with the way technology drives so much of our debates, not just our debates in the Congress. We see it, as I say, in what has come to me to be a completely worthless exercise, and that is sitting through a State of the Union address. I hated the thought of going there because there's no substance. It's just one soundbite after a soundbite after a soundbite interrupted by people bouncing up and down with unthinking applause. But the media feeds into that as well. Back in the days, some of you all here may remember, as I do, when the evening news was a half hour on ABC, NBC, or CBS. That was the benefit to that, to having those short, focused news programs, was they were focused. The networks and the producers for those programs had to sift through a huge amount of information, and one can disagree certainly with the particular stories that they might have selected, but generally speaking, they prioritized those things that were important and they articulated them. With 24/7 programming now, you don't have that prioritization. You have 24/7 babbling. Whatever might be somebody chasing. The Americans' appetite for watching police cars chase pickup trucks through Pomona or through Atlanta is utterly insatiable. Yet every time there's one of these things, we have it on the news over and over and over again. There's no real debate or understanding or prioritization of what's important or not. So the media, the 24/7 cable feeds into that, and we see that reflected also in the Congress. And a lot of it, as I said, it has to do with the structure of our system where one party is in absolute control, one party isn't, and everything centers around party, not ideas.
Here's a question that follows up on your comment about the media, asking whether the media not only exhibits sound bites, but in effect reduces people's attention span and reduces their desire for knowledge of the depth that you're speaking about.
It strikes me every time, and I have to admit, I watch very little cable anymore. I get most of what I digest every day in terms of news from, calling articles and pulling articles off the internet from the news services and the internet versions of the newspapers and so forth. But all you have to do is just watch one of these so-called news programs, and it's like so many even of the newspapers nowadays or magazines. It used to be you could pick up a Time magazine and you would actually read one or two columns. Now, it's hard to find the substance there because there is 5 or 6 or 10 different things on every page, and it's the same electronically with the news. You can't just have the news there. You've got to have the news, and then you've got to have that ticker across the bottom, and then you've got to have a banner over on one side talking about something different, and some guy advertising for some upcoming CSI or program or whatnot. None of it lends itself to actually focusing on substance. It's all about how many bells and whistles can you throw at people. And I really worry about the young people in future generations because it's all about the technology and the sound and the color, not the substance.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Bob Barr, former congressman and former Libertarian Party candidate for president, who's discussing his concerns about the growth of federal government and what he says are the related threats to individual liberties. Let's talk a little bit about the current state and the current climate in the Congress and in the government. There are words, every minute we're hearing the word filibuster being thrown out. You have Evan Bayh, who just announced his retirement from what many considered a very promising political career, saying that he felt government was broken and there was no hope. Are you getting to the point where you yourself see very little hope?
One of the most difficult things I have to do, George, every day when I wake up is to remind myself that there is hope. I think if I ever wake up one day and feel there is no hope, then I have no reason to be involved or no reason really to live. I think it's important not to lose one sense of hope, at least some pessimism that the system can work, that it can change. But I have to say it's getting more and more difficult to do that. And as I say, a lot of it, and this is not simply speaking to you as a libertarian, as a member of the third, America's oldest and largest third party, but simply as an American who has been involved, as everybody here has, in the political process. It is not working. And it's not the fault simply of one person or one party. We as a society have allowed ourselves to become locked into this notion of two parties. When everything centers around two parties, everything centers around partisanship. And it is terribly, terribly stifling. I don't see it changing anytime soon, other than if, in fact, President Obama is serious and will continue over the long term to do what he started last month when he went to the Republican caucus and engaged in a Q&A and a discussion with them. If he is serious about that, it can start at the top. I hope that he is. I think Senator By's words when he announced last week that he was not running for re-election are very telling and ought to be a wake-up call to the American people.
There are more questions here about the actual Federalist Papers and hearkening back to what was written there. What strikes you as most specifically resonant about those that people need to pay attention to today?
What strikes me most about the Federalist Papers is their utter relevance to what we're seeing today. Now, certainly, some of the verbiage in the Federalist Papers were very clearly oriented toward the time in which they were written, referring to some of the experiences of the state constitutions, referring specifically to reasons why these provisions that they were advocating as the Federalist should be adopted. Oriented towards particular constituencies in New York, for example. But removing that, maybe a third of the verbiage of the Federalist Papers, what we're left with is language that is remarkably relevant and illustrates to us a profound understanding both of history and of human nature. That is just so relevant today. I mean, when James Madison was talking, as I quoted a few minutes ago, about if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If we were governed by angels, then all of these mechanisms, the checks and balances, wouldn't be necessary. But we're humans. If we simply pay attention to what was crafted for us 2.25 centuries ago, we'd be so much better off. I mean, they understood it. They got it. They understood that you need to have checks and balances for the system to work. They did not propose that the president serves as the Article II chief executive and whatever he decides to do is okay because he's the president and he's the commander-in-chief. Yes, they gave certain enumerated powers to the president, and they're certainly reasonably implied powers as the chief executive. The same is for Congress. But to allow a president, as Mr. Obama's predecessor did, to take the position that because the president is the commander-in-chief, again, pulling out that one phrase that so many people like, and therefore can do whatever that president decides he needs to do as commander-in-chief, goes directly against the grain of what our framers envisioned for us and what we speak to, or at least say that we speak to as a nation.
There are questions here about your comments about John Yoo and related to what you just said, and whether there ever is a time that the executive's powers have the right to grow in which they did grow during the last Bush administration. Do you see any merit in any of John Yoo's arguments that there are sometimes need for extraordinary presidential powers during times of war?
Absolutely. I don't disagree with that as a notion, but I do part ways with John when it comes to, for example, there being a law that is on the books that expressly limits what a president can do in a certain arena, such as surveilling the citizenry, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, where you have a law that was explicitly crafted to prevent a president from using the powers of our foreign intelligence agencies to surveil American citizens without court order, then you've taken that issue off the table. And if one makes the argument that simply because a president is the commander-in-chief and simply because that president defines a global war on terror and simply because that president then decides that since anybody is a potential terrorist and any inch of our land can be a potential battlefield, the president has an absolute right to conduct electronic surveillance to find out what the enemy is doing, so to speak, as a battlefield commander could, you cannot square that power with a law that expressly says a president can't do that. If a president believes that he has to do that, then he has several very viable options open to him. Go to the Congress and ask them to amend the law, challenge it in court. But we should never go down and allow ourselves to be pulled down that slippery slope of a president saying he is above the law.
There is a question that cites and compares and wants you to compare your involvement with the Clinton impeachment and a movement to impeach George W. Bush, and because you expressed some strong views about that as well. How do you view both of those scenarios, and at what point, given all that you've seen and all that you now know, at what point should a president be impeached?
It's very, very, not only very timely, but I think the last time I was here was with Bruce Fine. Bruce Fine and I were here, I think it was a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken, and we were talking about that very issue. Bruce had proposed at the time, some steps in that direction with regard to impeachment. I was very disappointed in the last Congresses, both when the Republicans were in charge and then after the 2006 election, when the Democratic Party regained the majority, that neither of those Congresses held any hearings that delved into, inquired into, whether or not impeachable offenses had occurred under President Bush. Certainly, there was sufficient evidence out there to have at least launched an inquiry and some hearings to get to the bottom of these very serious issues, whether it is surveillance of U.S. citizens in violation of the law, whether it was the manner in which the former president potentially or possibly obstructed justice by improperly firing certain U.S. attorneys for either engaging in or not engaging in political prosecutions, or whether it was the issue of torture, again, in direct violation, it seems, of U.S. law. These matters certainly should have gone into, and I think shame on both the Republican Party when it controlled the Congress up to after 2006, and shame on the Democratic Party for the subsequent 2 years during the Bush administration for not inquiring into these matters, which they certainly could have done, which would have provided us a much clearer picture for whether or not impeachment was warranted.
Here's a question about how would the Federalists handle the debate on health care?
I think fairly quickly and fairly easily. No way is there any authority in the Constitution, implied or certainly explicit, for the federal government to force individuals to purchase insurance, to have insurance. That is not the job of the federal government. One can try and shoehorn it six ways to Sunday into the General Welfare Clause or the Commerce Clause, but I don't think that that James Madison or Alexander Hamilton or John Jay would have had any of that. There's no authority for it whatsoever.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Bob Barr, former congressman and former Libertarian Party candidate for president. There are some questions about you and your conversion from being a Republican to being a Libertarian. Why that happened, what you left behind.
I left behind in 2006 when I was invited to and gladly accepted an invitation to join the Libertarian Party as a member of its national committee. What I left behind was a party that bore no relationship, that is the Republican Party, to the party that I had been a member of for many, many years before that. A party that not only does not object to a president of its party appearing to violate the law and decimating the civil liberties of the citizenry, but applauds it, is a party to me that has lost its roots, does not care for the Constitution, and certainly does not practice what it preaches. I certainly had very serious concerns and objections to the manner in which George W. Bush had expanded federal spending, but it was really the former president and his administration, his Republican administration at the Department of Justice, and the vice president in particular, trampling on civil liberties, denigrating the very notion and the value of the great writ of habeas corpus, for example, violating the law to spy on American citizens without warrant, engaging in what clearly is torture. It's not an enhanced interrogation technique when you waterboard somebody. It's torture, pure and simple. And these things were done in violation of the law. To me, that is not a party that I could continue to be a proud member of.
Do you ever foresee a time when you could support a Republican candidate?
Yes. I mean, certainly if a Republican candidate came out there and said, I stand for the Constitution, I'm going to start, if elected, start dismantling the regulatory state and the various laws that that dictate personal behavior, which does not harm other individuals. If there were a Republican candidate that said that I want to put defense back in national defense and stop foreign adventurism and occupying foreign lands, you know, those are the sort of things that I could support in a candidate of any party. I don't hold out great hope that that's going to happen, but if it did happen, certainly I could support a candidate of whatever party.
Some questions about foreign policy. About the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the war on terrorism, whatever it's being called today. How would the Federalist look at all of that, and what hints, or better yet, what significant messages should we take from their writings regarding those issues?
I think our Federalists, while certainly they were speaking to these issues in an era on the surface much different from what we're viewing now, I think there are some striking similarities, and the fact that even in that era, in the late 18th century, when these issues were being debated and our Constitution and the Bill of Rights adopted, our nation faced tremendous threats. To be honest, the threats that we faced back then were much more serious than the threats we face today from somebody who wants to blow up their underwear or whatnot, as serious as that would be if it occurred. They faced, at that time, the military might of the greatest power on the face of the earth, the British Empire. The Brits still harbored some degree of ill will against us for beating them in our War of Independence. They wished to do us great harm, tried to do us great harm. In other words, these issues, that is, limitations on the federal government's power to surveil and search the citizenry, to quarter troops, to take away the right to keep and bear arms, power of the presidency, limitations on the power of the presidency, these issues were being debated and incorporated in the Constitution at a time when our nation faced very serious threats. Yet our founding fathers recognized, understood, that if the freedom that they had just fought so hard to secure were not protected by institutionalizing limitations on government power, we would lose it. So I think they would look at us today and say, you know, you're not alone. We faced challenges back then that were far greater than those you face today. If you give up your liberties, if you expand government power beyond the bounds that we laid out and worked so well for so long, then you will do that which you say you're trying to protect against happening, and that is you'll lose freedom. I think those limitations, whether we see it on government power, whether we look at it in the context of the First, the Second, the Fourth Amendment, or whatever, and if we read Alexander Hamilton, for example, in the Federalist 70, I think it might have been, discussing the role of commander-in-chief. It's not an affirmative grant of power to a president to do whatever that president wants. It's an administrative recognition that you have to have one commander-in-chief. I think they would be framers and the authors of the Federalist Papers would be very distressed with what they see happening. We can fight against acts of terrorism. We can fight against those, as we should, if we can link elements in Afghanistan to terrorist actions here. Certainly, we ought to use our forces in a limited way to address that, but simply occupying a nation, whether we call it that or not, engaging in multi-year, multi-decade even, efforts to change those societies is not the right way to do it, and it's not consistent with what our framers or the Federalist authors had in mind.
Some more questions on domestic issues. Instead of the financial bailout, what would the Federalists have said should have been done?
That's a more difficult one because what we see happening in terms of bailouts would be so alien to what the Federalists had in mind for the federal government to be involved in virtually every aspect of the economic life of our country on the macro level and on the micro level, which is what gave rise to both parties supporting this travesty of bailouts and buying into corporations. I mean, it's so alien to our framers, I don't think they would even understand what was going on, but I think clearly they would have very serious reservations in terms of why we no longer protect the sanctity of contracts when the government comes in and says to a shareholder of General Motors that your shares are going to be worth 10 cents on the dollar because we want to run the company differently and we're going to use taxpayer money. When the government comes in and says we're going to use taxpayer money to favor Acme Financial Institution as opposed to Ajax Financial House because we like them more, I think our framers would say, this is absolutely anathema. One, government shouldn't be doing it. Secondly, having government do it is not going to solve anything, and we're certainly seeing that. Multi-trillion dollar deficits. I mean, what is it, a trillion and a half in the current year? I mean, just unimaginable amounts of money. And that represents, even though that's all made-up money and borrowed money, it still comes out of our pockets in reduced buying power, reduced economic activity in the communities and so forth. There are a number of things that could have been done, I think, in terms of prosecuting some of the fraud that gave rise to this, appropriate regulation, but simply expanding the role of government in running the economy and running particular businesses does nothing but distort the economy.
A question about your opinion on the economy, which is where do we go from here?
Well, what I'd like to see us do from here is to at least start stanching the damage, stop running up the debt. Unfortunately, neither this administration nor the prior administration takes that view. The national debt increased tremendously under George W. Bush, and it has increased tremendously just in the first year that President Obama has been in power. What we need to do is we need to start reducing that. We need to start doing something, and we can't do it overnight. And I know some in my party would like to see these changes come immediately. You can't do that. You can't all of a sudden say, well, there's going to be no more Federal Reserve or we're going to do away with this department or that department. But you have to at least start the process and get serious about it. I'm afraid if we don't do that within the next couple of years, and I frankly don't see that happening, I think it's going to become virtually impossible to reverse that trend of ever-increasing debt. And you can sustain it for a while, but frankly, I don't feel real comfortable with China being our largest creditor nation or Brazil being the second or third, whatever it is. I think this is going to come back in a number of ways to haunt us, not just economically, but in terms of reducing and limiting our options in the international arena when you're in debt to other nations that may have different ideas about how things operate in the world than we do.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Bob Barr, former congressman and former Libertarian Party candidate for president. Some questions about the Tea Party. the Tea Parties and the Tea Party movement, and how would the Federalists feel about those, and how does Bob Barr feel about those?
I haven't been to any of the events. I'd read about them and see them and know a lot of the folks involved. I haven't been involved in them. If, in fact, these movements, and I guess they're careful not to call themselves a party, the Republican Party would like to co-opt them, and I think that's probably the greatest danger to the Tea Party movement is being co-opted by the Republican Party, and that seems to be a real danger. If, in fact, these movements are truly grassroots movements to educate themselves and their fellow citizens as to what's going on in Washington, particularly at the federal level, to educate people as to the real issues, to talk about the Constitution in a meaningful, substantive way, then I think it's good, and I think our framers would agree with that. They had very serious concerns, and if not disdain to some extent, with formal political parties. So I think they would look at these movements, if in fact they are positive-oriented, if they're not out there talking about arming themselves and so forth, which I don't think is appropriate. I think it's very dangerous. Some of them seem to be going in that direction a bit, but if it's positive, if it's truly educational to inform the citizenry, to activate the citizenry to be involved about these substantive issues, I think that's good. But it's awfully early to tell. I don't know if it'll really continue in that direction.
A related question, what is your opinion of Sarah Palin and her popularity?
She seems to be fairly popular. She's I have it right here. She's pretty popular. I've never met her. I was not impressed with her during the campaign 2 years ago and during the debate, so-called, that she had with Senator Biden. I have not been impressed with her handling or articulation of issues since then either. But she does seem to strike a chord with a lot of groups out there, which maybe tells us the level of public understanding and discourse and shows us how much work we have to do.
Some more questions about some domestic issues. Describe your stance on same-sex marriage. And another question related perhaps to some of what we've been talking about. How do you reconcile an opinion on social issues with a desire for less government? For example, doesn't pro-choice same-sex marriage legality create less government in terms of the restrictions on people's lives?
I'm not sure I followed all that, but to me, marriage, first and foremost, is not a federal issue. The federal government should have no business in it. Certainly, and I argued and testified, I believe, before the Congress about 4 or 5 years ago when the so-called federal marriage amendment was being debated. I think it would be terribly inappropriate for the federal government to get involved in that. I have called for, even though I was the primary author of the Defense of Marriage Act, for its repeal in light of how it's been used as a club to deny citizens of the various states the right to make their own decision with regard to same-sex marriage. That ought to be up to the individuals in particular states. It ought not to be the purview of the federal government, even indirectly, as we did allow and is currently allowed under the Defense of Marriage Act.
Question about the CIA. I was surprised to hear you used to be affiliated with the CIA. Many consider the operations and even experience of secretive intelligence agencies to be a major threat to liberty. How did your experience with the CIA influence your views, and do you think it's correct in keeping with the Federalist Papers and a free society?
I don't see if in fact, we have a central intelligence agency such as it was many years ago, when I had the opportunity to work there, this was in the 1970s, whose primary focus is to gather information, both covert and open information, on what's going on in the world, and to analyze that and present that and disseminate that to our policy leaders. Not only do I think that is not a threat or a danger to society, I think it carries out an absolute obligation and responsibility that our government has to know what's going on in the world and to equip our policymakers with the best and most current information. Unfortunately, what has happened, particularly in recent years, particularly under the prior administration, is the agency, which unfortunately has drifted ever since, to some extent, ever since the demise of the Soviet Union, which was its primary focus for two generations. It has drifted. It has not been given clear direction and directive. It has not taken the initiative in providing clear direction for itself, and it has allowed itself to become used in ways that I think are highly inappropriate and counterproductive. And I would like to see, and I hope the current administration follows through on some of its initial policies to hold the agency more accountable, but not to do away with its core mission. I think gathering intelligence information with regard to foreign nations, foreign leaders, goings-on in the world is essential. And I would like to see whoever occupies the White House pay closer attention and use that intelligence for purposes for which it's intended, that is to allow them to make better, more informed decisions rather than some of the ways that it's been used by the prior administration.
Thank you. A question about the Federalists and how they would view today's movement for green energy, how they would view the government getting very involved in encouraging and in some cases mandating people to practice certain energy-saving policies.
I think that the Federalists, they understood human nature a little bit better than our leaders in Washington and at the state levels do nowadays. I was reading on the flight out here today an article describing efforts by the government leaders in Boulder, Colorado, to make their community greener, and they take these steps to provide incentives and to provide money for people to make their houses greener, by putting light bulbs in, that you can hardly see with, and so forth. That was my editorializing. They believe otherwise. And they have found over the last few years, according to this article, that it just doesn't work. People are resistant to being forced to do those sorts of things. Well, then what government does, and I think the Federalists would understand this, what government nowadays does is if they provide those incentives and the citizenry doesn't embrace them and do exactly what the government leaders want, then those government leaders don't say, well, gee, maybe we did the wrong thing. Maybe we ought to back off. They say, well, we didn't go far enough. So then they try additional incentives and additional mandates and so forth. It doesn't work. If, in fact, there is an economic price in the marketplace to be paid by using energy too freely and irresponsibly, let the market take care of that. That's certainly what I believe, what we as libertarians believe, and what I think to a large extent the Federalists would believe. They understood the market. They understood that government should not and ultimately cannot, other than through force of government power and the threat of jail, force people to do things. They'll do it if there is a proper incentive through their social structure and through the market economy. To do that. If in Georgia, for example, in my home state, for 3 years before last year, we had a very serious drought. So we had very serious water shortages. Well, to me, the solution would have been if, in fact, the supply of water goes down because the supply of rain is going down, you increase the price. The price should go up. Well, government doesn't want to do that. They think that would, that might hurt people or whatnot or be unfair. So what they did is they instituted mandatory water restrictions. To me, it would have made a lot more sense to just let the market take care of that. And if people want to pay more to use more water and if they can afford it, fine, but sooner or later they're not going to be able to, and it'll balance out.
Thank you. A quick question about your movie career. You were in the movie Borat.
For which, by the way, I received no royalties. It's really, really irritates
me. An oversight that maybe can be corrected today. What do you think the fact that you were in it says about politicians or people in political life and the way they're viewed by the public?
Well, I'm not sure. Let me just give you a little background on how I got roped into that in my own defense. We had received in my office in Atlanta, it was probably about a year and a half or maybe even 2 years before the movie came out, we received a request in the normal course of events for a foreign journalist, somebody described as a foreign journalist, coming to Atlanta and wanting to interview me on some matters involving the Patriot Act and the Constitution and so forth, issues that I, at least at that time, was in the news a fair amount about. We were trying to reauthorize or not reauthorize the Patriot Act and so forth. So on the surface, it made sense. You know, we got this guy coming over, he wants to interview you on these things. We checked it out. And it seemed appropriate. Obviously, we didn't check it out quite enough, but we did at least nominal due diligence. It seemed appropriate. We made arrangements for when I was coming up to Washington at an office I had up there at the time to do the interview. The rest is sort of history. It started out as a legitimate interview, and then it deteriorated rapidly, and we threw the guy out of the office. In my own defense, I didn't say anything stupid. I didn't say anything. I think some of the individuals, I'm not saying I comported myself perfectly, but some of the things they said were pretty stupid. Just I think feeds into the public's perception of the low caliber of a lot of public officials that we have these days. I think the guy is a tremendous comedian, has a tremendous comedic sense. I think both that movie and I Didn't See the Successor one, pushed the envelope too far. But up to a point, I thought it was fairly funny.
Well, this leads into we have time for one last question. And here it is. Do you think you will run again for president in 2012? And do you think a Libertarian Party candidate can ever win?
No, and yes. I do not intend to run again. I enjoyed the experience tremendously of running in 2008 with the banner of the Libertarian Party, but I have no intention of running again. Do I think that a Libertarian could ever be elected? Yes, but an awful lot of things are going to have to happen before that's even remotely likely. Our political system is so stacked against the openness that would be necessary for a third-party candidate or a Libertarian or otherwise to stand a real chance at competing, even before you can win, just competing. It is so difficult with the current restrictions in federal campaign financing for a third party or an independent to raise money to compete. It is virtually impossible to break into the media, as we saw during the debates. They just won't allow it. That's going to have to change. In other words, our campaign laws are going to have to be opened up. The citizenry is going to have to demand that we open up our political system to have a real damn debate about these things, rather than just simply listening to the Republicans and Democrats take the opportunity of running for president and having that forum and simply saying what they want to say rather than what we need to hear. Ultimately, the answer to your last question is yes, it is possible, but it's only going to happen if the American people demand to have a real political system at long last.
Well, our thanks to Bob Barr, former U.S. Congressman and former Libertarian candidate for president, for joining us today.
Thank you.
We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm George Dobbins, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.